Pushkin. Few songs hit quite like this. Green Onions was recorded in two takes in 1962 by Booker T and the MGs. They were the house band for Stax Records in Memphis. This song was originally the B-side, but once it started making the rounds on radio, it was quickly re-released as the A-side, going down as one of the most recognizable instrumentals ever. Booker T, along with guitarist Steve Cropper, drummer Al Jackson Jr., and bassist Louis Steinberg, or depending on the year, Donald Duck Dunn, went on to record hits like Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, Hold On I'm Coming, and Soul Man, and in the process defined the sound of Southern Soul, which was way more gritty than the polished sound coming out of Motown. Over the last 60 years, Booker T has been writing, producing, arranging, and playing with some of your favorite artists, like Otis Redding, Neil Young, Willie Nelson, Bill Withers, and of course has been sampled in hip-hop like a James Brown drummer, songs by The Roots, Wu-Tang Clan, and others. He wrote about it in his memoir, Time is Tight, My Life Note by Note. Booker T sat with Bruce Hedlund in front of a Hammond C3 organ so he could talk and play us through his career. This is Broken Record Season 3, Liner Notes for the Digital Age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Bruce Hedlund speaking with Booker T from Bridge Studio in Brooklyn.
I do want to start today talking about your new book,
yeah.
Time is Tight,
yeah,
which is fabulous for many, many reasons, and I think everyone should read.
Thank you.
What interested me particularly was, you know, there's this perception people have of, I think particularly Southern musicians, soul musicians, that you guys learned everything in the church
mm-hmm.
or singing on street corners.
Mm-hmm.
You mm-hmm. were a serious music academic. You studied mm-hmm. very hard from an early age.
Mm-hmm.
How
mm-hmm.
did that, why did that happen?
Well, I think your first two elements of the formula are exactly correct. The church, I remember singing Jesus Loves Me as a little boy in Sunday school, and my first solo was in church. And then as I grew up a little earlier, some of my friends, I met Maurice White in sixth grade and David Porter in ninth grade, and they were singing in doo-wop groups on the street corner.
Mm-hmm.
And I came from a background where my grandfather built a school down in Holly Springs, Mississippi, and he mandated that his children go to school, first his school, and then that they go to high school and that they go to college. So all his kids, including my father, went. My father graduated MI and became a math teacher, and he wanted all his grandkids to do the same thing. So I was one of those. So mm-hmm. it was predetermined that I was going to study and go to college. And I saved up $900 on my paper route to that effect and studied Latin in the ninth grade. So, you know, and the music was came from my mother's side, the classical music. My grandmother was a piano teacher. She had a piano, taught my mother. My mother played Liszt, Debussy, Chopin in the house, and that music affected me. So I got it from a lot of different angles, including those first ones you mentioned.
When did you realize you were studying music? You started, I think, with a clarinet.
The clarinet was the first one I owned. The first one I started with was oboe, the first formal instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, as a little boy, I had a ukulele.
Oh, okay.
That got me into guitar. So I kind of see myself as a guitar player.
You see yourself as a guitar player now?
I pick it up first, usually when I'm writing a song.
When did you know music was going to be your life?
As a young boy, I started hearing music in my mind since I can remember, various sounds and melodies, and I didn't know what to call them, you know. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, was the challenge as I grew older, what to call everything. So that's where the formal education came in, you know, taking piano lessons, organ lessons, theory lessons in high school. I had to put a name to everything, you know, so I could communicate mm-hmm. with the outside world, you know.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. these are, you know, this is pre-integration, your school. You went to an all-black school.
Went to an African-American school, sang in the choir in the first grade at Porter Junior High School, which was all blacks, no whites.
Uh-huh. But the music education was really intense, and you took theory lessons after school.
Mm-hmm. That was in 10th grade, starting mm-hmm. in about 1959, mm-hmm,
right.
60.
And then there's this amazing passage in your book where you are, this is years later, you're working at Stax.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're doing the arrangement for When Something Is Wrong With My Baby, the great Sam and Dave song. And I think the next thing that happens is you're trying to figure out, you're at college at that point in Indiana,
mm-hmm,
you're trying
mm-hmm.
to figure out what you're going to play for your trombone recital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were coincidental. Uh-huh.
So you were flying back and forth to
yeah.
do Stax sessions from, and you were getting an education at one of the great music colleges in the country.
I think you mentioned a great instance. I play, you know. Something with my baby. That's a great, you know, combination of a church feeling, you know, mm-hmm. the way the notes move in the bass, and the classical combination of those influences in my life. But the church, I think, was the strongest influence in my musical makeup.
One of the other influences you mentioned, and this is fascinating to me, and I'd love you to walk me through it,
mm-hmm.
was when you wrote Green Onions,
mm-hmm.
and I think you were probably 19 or something.
I was 17.
17. Mm-hmm. But you said it's because you'd studied Bach counterpoint.
Yeah. I wanted to go to UCLA or Indiana University, so I had to pass a theory. I had to pass a jury to go to Indiana University. Mm-hmm. They were going to ask questions about the basics of music. How was music put together? Well, that's where my theory class started, you know, the scale. 12 mm-hmm. notes in the scale. And what are they? The third. And what are the chord changes? The way I moved those notes were basically dictated by J.S. Bach, contrapuntal movement. You know, mm-hmm. it makes sense if you didn't think about it, but it's ingrained in our Western society, what I just played. That's the way the notes move. Other countries, or whatever.
Different scales, yeah.
So in figuring that out, I what if a note went? That's where the blues came in. Changing this from a major third to a minor third.
Mm-hmm.
That third one, 2-3, what about the minor three? So that's where Green Onions came from. Instead of. And I thought, what if the third was a minor? And what if the top moved down like a Bach?
Because Bach and counterpoint, the top.
Exactly.
It moves in the opposite direction
exactly.
of the bass.
The bottom moves up. I mean, the bottom moves up while the top moves down.
Wow.
So I kind of played that on the piano. I thought, that sounds kind of cool, you know? And then the changes, of course, were just regular blues changes that we played all the time. You go from that to the B flat. And then back to the one. So it's a 12-bar blues, basically. But it has this for its second chord instead of... I think it would feel different if I played it like that. So that's basically the history of how Green Onions came about.
And was there a particular Bach song that inspired that, or just it was just general
theory?
No, it
was just contrapuntal rules, just the rules that we learned, you know, and that's the major scale.
And I want to go back to your education and more about Memphis,
mm-hmm.
but there's one other great example you mentioned in the book. There's many great examples,
mm-hmm.
but you wrote the great Albert King song, Born Under a Bad Sign.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you said you picked a particular key for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where that came from. That, you know, that door opened. We got a call, we being myself and my partner, William Bell, that we were staff producers at the time. And we were responsible for recording Albert King. And he was coming down the next day. So we went into my den the night before, Friday night, to write something for him. And... that came into my mind, and William had been working on the lyrics content, Born Under a Bad Sign. He'd been working on that for himself. So the two came together that night before. But then, you know, at Indiana, I had learned about, you know, the urgency that you could put into certain keys that were not inherent in some keys. Music is music is part of our atmosphere. And some keys have more emotional content than others. So I went to C flat minor for Albert, you know. D flat minor, same key.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this
is. C sharp.
Yeah, yeah.
C sharp minor.
So
yeah.
This is different. That's Albert's key.
Yeah.
And the way he played his guitar. So he pulled his strings, you know, on those keys, and we got this tension, you know, and this mm-hmm. this emotional necessity out of this song. And it just makes, just playing it right here now makes you feel kind of differently. It's like something ominous is you know.
And you think that, and that came from the key?
That came from going from here to here.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you liked C sharp.
Wagner.
Wagner.
Chopin, you know, they played in those keys. They didn't mind writing six sharps, you know. They made the musicians play in those keys, and mm-hmm. but it had this feeling, you know, this emotion, you know, and the blues in that key is just unbelievable, you know, to me.
But it's not a common key for blues, though.
Well, I don't know. It was perfect for this and for Albert. I think a lot of blues musicians when I was on in Memphis played in the simpler keys, you know, F and maybe C or G minor. But when you go to the minor keys like that, the A flat, G sharp minor, there's another element that comes in. It's, I guess it's the way the universe is put together, the makeup of the atoms or something. it's more emphatic.
Yeah.
And so Born Under Bad Signs in C sharp minor.
Wow.
The same way as Chopin's concertos. And it was very great, good key for Albert. He just killed it.
Now, he was a guitar player, so it's a little easier to move.
And he's also a right-handed guitar player, kind of like Jimi Hendrix. So it wasn't such an issue. You know, left-handed guitar players have to push the strings, but a right-handed guitar player like Albert can pull the strings. So he had more strength, more physical strength over there.
Right.
On the upper string. So he just killed it. It was a great experience.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
I want to go back to, we talked about sort of your academic background, but then you started playing along Beale Street.
Mm-hmm.
Now people now know Beale Street because of the Baldwin book, and mm-hmm. They just made it into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it was this famous street in Memphis where mm-hmm. you're from.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what it was like playing in those clubs back then? You were just a kid.
Yeah, I was right off of Beale Street on Hernando, just about a couple of doors down at the Flamingo Room upstairs on the second floor. Was where they were the only ones that actually let me in. Cliff Miller was the owner of the place, and it was his place, so he brought me in. And I couldn't get into the Club Handy, which was on the other side of Beale. That was Sunbeam Mitchell's club. I was too young, and I guess he could have broken the rules and had me in, but Cliff was the one that was interested in me. He brought me in to play bass, and I played bass in Gene Bolek's Miller's band and Willie Mitchell's band.
Mm-hmm. How long had you played the bass at that point?
I picked up the string bass at Booker Washington Junior High School. They had a bass, and I played mm-hmm. some bass in the combo there.
Yeah. By the way, this is probably a good time to pause and say, your name really is Booker T.
My name is Booker T. Jones. I was named after my father, Booker T. Jones Sr., who was named after Booker T. Washington, who mm-hmm. was an educator and built a college, Tuskegee. What was it, Tuskegee? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In the South.
Mm-hmm. And you attended Booker T. Washington High School.
Booker T. Washington High School. Yes,
yeah.
I did. Uh-huh.
Okay. So you were playing in these clubs. Were they rough clubs? Was it strange for a kid to be in there?
Yes, it was unsafe. I mean, there was a lot going on Beale Street. You know, Beale Street was everything from, you know, prostitution and whiskey running. And there's a lot of stuff going on down there. My parents picked out a couple of musicians they trusted to watch over me. They picked out Floyd Newman to take me home at night and take mm-hmm. me over to the club. He hated it. But my dad had been his algebra teacher, but he did it anyway.
So your dad had been his algebra. You had to listen to your dad.
Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah.
But your dad is, you know, he's a high school teacher.
Yeah.
He's always in a white shirt and tie.
Yeah.
And he thinks it's okay for you to play at these clubs?
Well, you know, my dad appreciated, my dad supported my musical passion. And mm-hmm. if I wanted to do it, he sat out so many clubs out in the countryside while I played, and he just supported and bought me the instruments, and he was my benefactor, you know. Mm-hmm. There may be a picture in the book of him in his algebra class with his white shirt and tie on his pointer, you know, teaching kids to calculate.
Yeah, he seems mm-hmm. like just an amazing character.
He was. I don't know if I wouldn't be here without him. I mean, he bought the first clarinet, and he just you know, took me and put Maurice White's drums in the back of his car and Frank Easley's bass, fit all that stuff in his car, and took us to the clubs. And
mm-hmm.
yeah.
He may be the nicest algebra teacher who ever lived.
He was great. A lot of people loved him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then at 16, you started, it wasn't called Stax then, it was called Satellite, but you did your first session.
Yeah, I was 15. I was in 10th grade. And the guy, Floyd Newman, I was telling you about, was their baritone sax player, but he was mm-hmm. also a high school teacher. So he couldn't make this particular session because he was in school. And David Porter came and got me out of school, my algebra class, 10th grade algebra class, to play for Rufus and Carla Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
Played baritone sax on their Cause I Love You, their first record at Stax. And that's
got a lot of baritone sax, that record.
It does. I played through the whole song.
Well, yeah. How many takes did you do?
Oh, I don't know. That was a pretty, we didn't take too much time to record that. That was like close to being a first take, I think, something like that.
And then did you get more sessions after that?
I did. I took the opportunity to tell them that I could play piano because, you know, it was Floyd Newman's job to play saxophone over
right.
there, baritone sax. I couldn't take his yeah. job.
I like how you cut school to do it. Yeah,
yeah. yeah
He's a teacher. He can't cut class. You can.
Yeah. So I was there and I told him I could play piano, and I got the job working after school as a session player.
Right.
After that, when they found out I could play piano.
Do you remember some of your other early sessions?
Yeah, the first one I remember was Prince Conley. Oh my goodness, what was that song? Yeah, it was a great blues song. I'm Coming Home, I'm Going Home, mm-hmm. by Prince Conley.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first, and I played the organ solo on that one. That was a blues song.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now you are sitting in front of a B3, a Hammond B3.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the speaker in the other room.
Yeah, I think this is a C3.
This is a C3?
Because okay. It's got the wooden sides over here.
Okay. Now, mm-hmm. I was just told the C3 was the church version.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. so that you couldn't you couldn't see the organist's legs.
Yeah.
Underneath.
Oh, really? Is that why?
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was heavier. It looks better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you talk a lot about the B3 or the C3, the Hammond,
mm-hmm.
that it could make any sound you imagined.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that?
Well, you have drawbars you can pull out and mix the tones.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know of any other instrument that you can do that on.
I can't
think of any other instrument that you can change like that. You can't do that with the oboe. You can't do it. Maybe guitarists can do it, but I don't know if they can do it as quickly.
Right,
as
in the middle
what
of a song.
You just heard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that was about five different sounds there from one note there.
Mm-hmm. Was there one particular sound that grabbed you, or was it the variety that got you?
The variety, I mean, that's what my teacher told me. When I saw the thing, her name was Mrs. Cole, and I tried to get lessons on her. She said, you know, you can make any sound you want with this instrument. You can make it sound like a big full orchestra or a clarinet or, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was what she told me. It was the opening up of those possibilities, I think, that sucked me in.
And did she teach you gospel style, or did she teach you?
No, she started with this. My first lesson with her. Well-tempered clavier.
Yes.
Bach.
Mm-hmm. If he lived long enough, he might have written Green Onions.
He would have. He was an inspired dude, man.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Booker T after the break. We're back with more from Booker T.
When did you start arranging and writing at Stax?
That started with working on David Porter and Isaac Hayes' song. Sam and Dave's songs, Otis Redding's songs, they gave me the freedom to change their songs around the way I heard them. I worked on Baby. They had written it a different way, and I gave it kind of a Motown feel. I changed the bass line. And, they let me change When Something Is Wrong With My Baby. Some of the, when we were working on Try a Little Tenderness, Otis gave me the freedom to work with the bass parts and the chordal changes in that. And they were all open to my changes.
Can you show me what you did on a song like, you mentioned Carla Thomas, Baby, which was a song she didn't like, and then you finally made it work. What did you do?
I gave it a little Motown feel like that. I changed the bass line and I changed the tempo and the melody. But the melody is the same as they wrote. The words, they wrote the words and lyrics same as they wrote.
Did you change any of the chords underneath?
No. It's the same chords they wrote.
Yeah.
It's just the way it feels.
Now, were you guys, I mean, Stax was this incredible factory of hits. Were you competitive with Motown? Were you looking at what they were doing and saying, we're going to beat them?
Not at all. I think we were, we used Motown as an instructive element because they were so great, so knowledgeable. They made so many good decisions with their music, and it was so much fun to listen to. But we didn't consider ourselves in competition because we were so different. You know, we were simplistic. We talked about not making the music too complicated and keeping it accessible, you know, with the bass lines and the drum beats. So to me, it wasn't competitive at all. I don't think we could have competed with them, really.
Can you tell me about meeting Otis Redding for the first time?
Yeah, Otis was an humble guy. He was, you know, he was really excited about making music all the time. He was willing to do everything, carry the instruments and go get the food. And he was the driver for Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers. And first time I met him, he was out on the street loading the suitcases onto the sidewalk. You know, do you need anything? And, you know, what can I do? And then, can I sing a song? No, he can't sing a song. Well, let me sing a song.
You never had somebody, a roadie, wanting to sing before?
Yeah, no, roadies didn't do that. And we let him sing, and then he wasn't a roadie anymore after he sang the first two lines of These Arms of Mine. He was sitting right here next to me. And, of course, then by that time, we wanted to get the tape rolling and record this guy.
So did he say play this chord, or did he just start singing his own?
No, it was all intuitive. He didn't mention any chords, but he started right in on key. You know, so either he had perfect pitch or something, but I didn't have to play any notes for him before he started. He knew exactly what key to sing in, and it was his song. So he was just an instant, I don't know, maybe he was the easiest in that way, actually.
And then, but you added a lot of different things to his songs.
As time grew on, he would look over. He would look over to me, and he dictated a lot with his mouth. He would hum, you know, that he would sing, you know, fa, 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 fa. He would sing the lines to the horns, but a lot of the intricate stuff that I did underneath, he allowed me to do, you know.
Well, you just mentioned the sad song, fa, 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 that song. I can't sing it, but you just sang a little bit of it. And that's a song you would, a beautiful accompanying to.
But a better example would be, you are time. You want to be free. So, you know, the walk up to that, those are the freedoms that I had to with him, was to insert musical elements to help the build the and he would wait for things like that, you know. So Well, yeah, he was dictatorial, but he also gave a lot of freedoms with the music. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just going to wait for a minute for the hair on the back of my neck to go back down, because that was just so fantastic.
Yeah.
And then there was so much, the way you describe it, he was in San Francisco for a while and he wrote Dock in the Bay. And then there was so much excitement around what became his last album.
Mm-hmm.
Just the making of it, you describe the place being almost kind of in a, not a frenzy, but almost a kind of.
It was a state of siege, to be honest with you. He sneaked it on us. We knew that Steve had kind of prepared us. Steve was kind of the foreman at Stax. He was the A&R guy. And he told us we were going to be recording some new sessions with Otis, but we didn't know they were going to be nonstop sessions. And we didn't know that they were going to be song after song after song, and that it would, you know, include not going home and staying in the studio and ordering food in. We never did that before. That was the only time we ever did that, stayed in the studio day after day after day. And I think it culminated with that song, Sitting on Dock of the Bay. But there were so many great ones, and it just went one to the other. So, yeah, so there was a mental attitude of that maybe Otis had a premonition that he needed to record those songs immediately without any, you know, any delay of taking a night off or a day off or that type of thing.
And you played piano on Dock in the Bay.
I played piano on almost everything during those sessions.
And was Try Little Tenderness part of those sessions as well, or was that earlier?
No, that was earlier.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because that arrangement, I mean, it's an old song.
Mm-hmm.
Is so unusual. Even now when you hear it, it's sort of disarming.
Mm-hmm.
How did you put that song together?
That was a trip that I made down from Indiana to play on that. My contribution was to raise the keys rather than playing it in one key.
So it moves up during the course of the song.
Oh, that's what it was. It was a walkout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the kind of theory type of thing. It was this part here. And this part here was Al and Otis. That was when Otis was looking at Al Jackson. Al Jackson made these stomps.
Right.
Got lots of child, little tenderness. Yeah, I think this was one of his kind of foot stomping masterpieces that he came up with and sang the lines to the horns and had this interaction with Al Jackson Jr., the drummer.
Yeah. Now, when you were arranging, were you writing out charts for the horns, or was it more informal than that?
This one was informal. This one was a head chart. I didn't put anything on paper. I don't think we had strings on this song. But when we had strings and we could always tell the horn players to play by ear and just hum the lines to them. But when we had strings, then we had to write it down.
Yeah, string players can't do that, let's face it.
Yeah, well, they can, some can, but usually I would just, you know, write a chart for them.
Is a sort of incredible scene in your book at Otis Redding's funeral when you were supposed to perform and you couldn't.
Yeah, that was tough. That was tough. I was there in this big auditorium for Otis Redding's funeral in Macon, Georgia. And, it was a song that I'd played in church 1,000 times. And I think I had brought the music just in case I got in trouble. And I think, who was it? Joe Simon was going to sing. And I heard the children walked in and then the widow walked in. And my professionalism left me.
And it was a song, Near the Cross?
Near the Cross. I played that so many times. Near the cross, there's a mm-hmm. near the cross, feel like a river. When my raptured souls have I rest beyond the That's what I was supposed to play. I couldn't think of that to save my life.
Well, you just played it for him, so that's.
But I couldn't think of it at his funeral. I just, you know.
Did you finally get it out, or?
I think I finally got the music out. I had to put it on the mm-hmm. on the organ and played it. And once I saw the notes on the page, and I remembered it.
Wow. Now, I want to talk just about a couple of the songs you did. You did. A lot of those songs as mm-hmm. Booker T and the MGs, mm-hmm. but Soul Dressing was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come up?
I would call that an Indiana song. I drove so many hours down Highway 37 from Indiana. That's me driving down, looking around at the houses, the farmhouses. That was what was going through my mind when I was driving. Mm-hmm. Always. And that's when a lot of the melodies came to me, when I was driving, north and south on Highway 37 through Kentucky and Indiana, northern Tennessee. The scenes, the pastoral scenes,
mm-hmm.
and those kind of peaceful scenes.
Would you pull over and write them down?
I just try to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Just try to remember it. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I want to ask about Slim Jenkins' joint.
Mm. That was New York City. I came up with that in Memphis on piano. I think I ended up playing piano on it. The story about that song, it seems like every song has a story. But when you mentioned that, we were trying to record that song in New York, and it was at Atlantic Studios Cream had, I guess it was Cream, had just become a big act there. And I just, if somebody, if we were working in here right now and someone came in and sat there and I was coming up with something new, it would just totally distract me. I'd lose my concentration. So I would say, if anybody else in the studio that's not actually working on the record, would you just please, just step outside, or just don't be here now? Because I got distracted. We're working on this song. Got the track down and everything. Time came to put the organ in, and this fella comes in, and he just walks in. Nobody says. He sits down, like right over here by the wall, and crosses his legs and doesn't look at me. Just sits there, and I'm supposed to do the organ part, right? I'm totally distracted. All I can do is look at this guy, and I found out it was Eric Clapton, and he basically owned the place at that point. I walked over to Tom Dowd. I said, Fellas, right there. Oh, it's just Eric. Just don't mind. It's just Eric. It wasn't a big deal to Tom. They weren't distracted at all.
Your engineer was Tom Dowd.
Yeah, Tom.
Great. Uh-huh. Great. Yeah.
And he says, just go. And so I walked back out there, and I played that, but I swear I could not get my mind off. Who the hell is this sitting in here like mm-hmm. that? And I asked him a few years later, when we were down in Texas, I came to play there. Eric Clapton, he had a guitar festival down in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And I said, was that you? Yeah, that was me. He just wanted to check out the session. Well, people did that normally,
Right.
Other people did that. They had other people come in and sit in there. But I was always so private and so, so focused. It kind of distracted me to have mm-hmm. somebody, unless they were working on the music. Anyway.
There's another great scene in your book where... you play the Monterey Pop Festival.
Is that in the book? Did I talk about that?
Yeah.
Oh, that
where you, you guys, you're there with Otis Redding.
Yeah.
You're wearing, I'm not sure they were matching suits, but you're wearing beautiful suits and you're incredibly professional. And you go back to your hotel and there's just like hippies hanging around everywhere.
Yeah.
You're like, what the, who are these people?
We stuck out like a sore thumb. It was amazing.
But it became this legendary performance.
It was. It was. Uh-huh. Yeah, we wish we had some other clothes because it was, we had these suits made at Lansky Brothers, you know, in Memphis. Everybody went there because that's where Elvis had his stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
And they were great. They could get you suited up quickly and they made nice stuff.
Yeah, but you looked like algebra teachers compared to everybody.
Absolutely, yeah. They were green silk suits, you know, conservative suits, and that's what we wore on stage. That's what we thought we were supposed to wear. Al Jackson, you know, that was his idea, and that's what we did.
Mm-hmm. You know, in Memphis in the time, the MGs were sort of held up. I don't know if they were held up at the time, but they are now as an integrated band. There weren't many integrated bands in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And you were probably the most famous mm-hmm. at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Were you conscious of what was going on in Memphis at the time before, for example, Martin Luther King came and he was killed there, but mm-hmm. for the garbage men strike? Was that stuff?
Not so much conscious of the fact that we were integrated. That was a subtext. It was not important.
You didn't think much of it?
Didn't think much of it, that the bass player was white and the guitar player was white. It was not a big deal. But, you know, like I said, we were family, so we were close, you know. It was kind of a big surprise to me later when I would, you know, do interviews, and that would be the first question that people would ask. Well, my God, they're more interested in our difference in races than they are in the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would get questions like that from overseas. But no, we were aware, of course, that we were of different races, but it was not a pervasive issue. We liked the way those guys played, and they were together. They were part of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were part of them.
Mm-hmm. It became an issue after Martin Luther King was killed, and Steve Cropper.
It became a bigger issue.
Mm-hmm. Said some things mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. seemed to blame Martin Luther King for stirring things up in Memphis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you?
At different times, it was of different difficulties. Later years, it was more difficult than it was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was unaware that in 1968, it was a very pervasive, multi-headed octahedron working in Memphis against exactly what we were doing. There was a huge establishment that was dedicated to separate people like us and not have what was going on at that 9926 Macklemore going on. There were people in Memphis who didn't want Freedom Riders to come into town and work towards that. But I was unaware of it at the time, which was a good thing, I think, because you know it would have hindered the music making mm-hmm. had I been aware of how strong the opposition was to races working together.
When we come back, we'll pick back up with Booker T and more on the complications of playing soul music in the South. We're back with more of Bruce's conversation with Booker T.
There's an incredible scene in your book
mm-hmm.
when you decide you're going to leave
mm-hmm.
Stax, which at mm-hmm. that point is run by Al Bell.
Mm-hmm.
And you write a song and play it for him.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me that story?
Yeah. I think, you know, it was the beginning of my trying to increase my awareness in general and kind of realizing that I could maybe think on a different level. And I became aware of this huge, I'll have to call it a monster, a multi-headed monster that was moving about Memphis, where I was, that was effectively dictating to two races of people, dictating to whites, dictating to blacks, and it was undetectable to most people. But I think I became aware of this, and I wrote the song about it, and called "Old Man Trouble," mm-hmm. about defeating this unknown force that you couldn't see, and doing it in your own mind, and getting your mind free.
Do you remember any of the song now?
Yeah, there's a man called Trouble. And he follows me everywhere I go. Now, old man Trouble, you can't get me now, I know. So yeah, it was a song that I did, and I spent a lot of money on it. Did a big horn arrangement, string section, Al Jackson, Ronnie Compone and those guys were. It actually got Stephen Stills recorded a few years later on one of his solo albums.
Mm-hmm. So you played this for Al Bell, and Al Bell mm-hmm. was African American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he had become the president. He was the leader of the company. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was reminiscent for me of Sam Cooke's "A Change Is Gonna Come." You know, it was 1968. You could feel it in the air in 1968. You know, it was a pivotal year for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And but this was a real thing. This was a dynasty that was at work in Memphis. It was an oppressive force that was working there. And, mm-hmm. But it was not up at the surface, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he didn't have a good reaction to the song. It upset him.
He had the same reaction, I think, that he would have. I think he even mentioned Sam Cooke's song. He was the president of a record company that was about to really break open, and it had to make its statement. The company eventually did make the statement as a voice of Black America, but he wanted to be, I think, a little more gradual than the song would have dictated. Mm-hmm. It was an interracial company at the time. You know, it wasn't just a Black America, a Black record company. I think as I said in the book, I think we had the same goal. You know, Al actually had been part of Dr. King's team at one point. We had the same goal, but I think we were taking different directions toward it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then after you played it for him,
mm-hmm.
you went back into the studio.
Yeah.
And can you tell me what you did?
Yeah, we didn't make a deal that night, which is what I had wanted. I went to his house looking for a deal, and it became apparent. I looked at his face. We weren't going to make a deal. I realized that it was just time. It was time to go. So I wanted to sever all my links with the company. So I walked into the control room, and I erased anything new that I had done at that point.
Including that song,
yeah.
And you couldn't, what was it, you had to tape over it. You couldn't reverse the tape, right?
No, and I'm sort of glad I did, because they had the freedom. They owned all the masters, and they could put out anything they wanted after I left. So if I was going to make any decisions, it had to be that night. And so, yes, I erased multiple machines by pressing the record button.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then just went home and packed and went to California.
It's like a scene from a novel, just these machines running and you just leave. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did. It turned out they put out many outtakes of the MGs, stuff that we weren't finished with, that we hadn't even named. And I heard stuff like, well, we're not finished with that one. And they other companies bought the masters from Stax, a Fantasy bought mm-hmm. Stax, and then they just put out what they wanted to without permission. They owned it. So if you're leaving a record company, you can't leave anything there. Mm-hmm. You know,
and then you went to California.
Yeah.
You didn't have a lot of money.
Didn't have a lot of money.
Because you didn't, I can't remember what you were making at that point at Stax, like $125 a week or something.
Well, my first deal with Herb Alpert was more than I had made in Memphis in a year. Yeah, mm-hmm. my first deal mm-hmm. with him. Yeah, they made me very comfortable. Mm-hmm.
But you describe yourself as almost being a little at sea after your time at Stax, trying to figure out what was next.
Mm-hmm.
But then you almost immediately discover Bill Withers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that story.
It was another almost 2 years before Bill was brought to me. I got a phone call from Clarence Avan, a friend of Al Bell's. Clarence had sold Stax for Al Bell. He had sold mm-hmm. Stax to Paramount. And so Al was crazy about Clarence Avan. It was Clarence this, Clarence that for a long time. We kept our relationship, although I didn't stay there. And Clarence called, and he was very excited about this guy in Inglewood that was building airplane toilets. And he was a carpenter,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted me to listen to his songs. He described him as a songwriter. And Bill came out to my ranch in Malibu with a big, thick notebook full of songs. And
what kind of guy was he?
A friendly guy, you know, very, just like he is, very happy, joking, making a lot of jokes, and kind of unassuming, kind of a little like Otis was. But basically, Bill's mentality is that of a carpenter. He's, you know, he's always looking to build something. He's always doing something in some of his kids' houses or changing something in an apartment. And secondarily, as a songwriter. Mm-hmm. That's this kind of person he is. When we walked into the studio, he asked me, I had everything like the setup. I had drums, bass, brought people out from Memphis and ready to record the songs. And he says, who's going to sing these songs? And
he just wanted to be a songwriter, not a performer?
Yeah, he saw himself as a songwriter and a carpenter and saw it as a side project. Uh-huh.
And what was the first song he sang?
Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone.
So how long did it take you to say, oh, I think you're really good?
I never said that. But I did. I know that now in that book, he had songs. I didn't get the best. Well, I got some great ones, but I didn't get Lean On Me. I didn't get, he had all those in the book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you produced one of the biggest albums of, I think, all time, which is Willie Nelson's Stardust.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
That was when I was living in Malibu. I had an apartment, and Willie had rented the apartment underneath me, which I had thought was empty because I never saw anybody down there. But one day I saw him running up the beach, the redheaded guy that looks just like Willie Nelson. Of course, it was Willie Nelson. Mm-hmm. He waved because he's just a friendly guy.
Did you know his work by that point?
Oh, of course, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I knew it was Redheaded Stranger and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was so surprised when he turned in and came into the gate to my unit. And he saw me. I stayed out there, and we realized that we were neighbors, and that's when we started jamming at mm-hmm. night. He'd come up to my deck because I had an electric piano right by the window, and we'd jam there. And the songs we jammed on, just messing around with each other, were the ones that ended up on the Stardust album. Mm-hmm.
And then you played bass on for Bob Dylan for Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a bass player. That was my first real gig in Memphis. That was how I got most of my gigs, was on bass.
Mm-hmm. But you said earlier you still regard yourself as a guitar player.
I did, yeah. I have guitars all over the house and all over my studio.
So that's the first thing you kind of think of when you're writing?
That's it. I had a Sears Silvertone. That's me playing a Sears Silvertone on William Bell's Forgot to Be Your Lover.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
You also wrote a great guitar lick, which I don't think enough people know about, which is the opening to Eddie Floyd's Big Bird?
Big Bird, yeah.
That's a fabulous lick.
And thanks.
You sort of hint in the book that like the guitarists were, why don't you stick to the organ? Like they didn't want the competition.
Yeah, exactly. But that's me on the Silvertone, yeah, playing that.
That was a Sears guitar?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Wow. And then you ended up working with Neil Young, mm-hmm. Sinead O'Connor.
Mm-hmm. Drive-By Truckers.
Drive-By Truckers. Mm-hmm. You redid a Jackie Wilson song that became a big hit for
Rita Coolidge.
For Rita Coolidge, mm-hmm. who was your sister-in-law at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But you totally changed that song, and it became a big, big hit.
Yeah, yeah. I had worked with Jackie Robinson, Jackie at the Regal Theater in Chicago. Oh, what an entertainer. He was dynamic. And that song just... But I often sometimes hear a song and a new or different arrangement will come to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that was. I had recorded that on myself, and Rita heard it.
And took it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you got a new album, which is called Time... Well, it's not called Time is Tight, but it's
Note by Note.
And it's a companion to...
To the book, yeah.
And what inspired you to do that?
Well, the chapters are the same as the chapter titles of the book. The songs on Note by Note are 'Cause I Love You, which is the first chapter of the book. And it's the first song I ever played on in a studio. Played baritone mm-hmm. sax on that in the first chapter. So it's the first and the last. We made a new recording of 'Cause I Love You with Evie McKinney from the Stax Museum. You know, they have some great talent there, mm-hmm. this young talent at the Stax Museum, and Joshua Ledet. And, you know, some of the American Idol winners and some of the new voice winners. And Ty Taylor is on it singing These Arms of Mine. And my son Ted, who is my new accomplice, has two songs on there. He's a... Mm-hmm. He's my go-to guitarist now and songwriter, and it's a composite of a lot of the chapters of the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there more new stuff? Are there people you want to work with now?
Oh yeah, there's a new album coming with Teddy Jones, my son.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like every song's different, but on the new album, Note by Note, there's Maybe I Need Saving that we wrote together. And then there's Paralyzed that's getting a lot of good airplay now that we mm-hmm. wrote together. And there's Matt Berninger of The National sent me 20 songs a few months ago. And we've recorded that And I'm really excited about that. A new album for him called Serpentine Prison.
Mm-hmm.
And he's
which is out now, isn't it?
I think. No, it's not out yet.
No, okay.
No, we just finished the production on it. He's just done a lot of work and written some really great music. And he's the one that I worked with on Representing Memphis here in New York with the Roots with Sharon Jones. They did that duet together.
Right.
That's where we met a good while ago, and we've become friends.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned this in the book. You know, people expect to hear Green Onions, and they expect to hear the hits when you see them. And I don't know what it's like for you to play them, but there is a great story about President Obama when you met him. Can you just tell that?
Yeah, we were doing a special at the White House, and the president was at the back of the house waiting to walk in. And usually bands are expected to play Hail to the Chief. And I happened to be playing Green Onions, and he and his wife, he and the First Lady, started walking in, well, actually kind of bopping in to Green Onions. And that got filmed, that got on tape, and he expressed a preference for whenever I was around to walking into Green Onions, rather than Hail to the Chief.
That is beautiful.
Yeah, I love that song.
Booker T's memoir is out now. And be sure to check out BookerT.com to see when you can catch him and his band on the road. You can check out some more of his music by visiting BrokenRecordPodcast.com, where we have a playlist available for you to listen to. And while you're there, sign up for a behind-the-scenes newsletter. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mia LaBelle, and Leah Rose for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music is by Kenny Beats. Stay tuned for next week's episode with Richard Russell of XL Recordings. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.